Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 11 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. From hardcore historians to armchair historians, everyone loves a good old-fashioned medieval mystery. There's something about medieval murder that catches the imagination, giving us the opportunity to pick up clues that lead not only to the identity of a killer, but also to a better understanding of a time and place that is endlessly fascinating. Building a mystery is tricky business, though, especially when every clue and every suspect comes from a world so materially and culturally different from our own. So how does an author walk that particular tightrope? To answer this question, I invited Candace Robb, the author of my favorite medieval mystery series, to speak with us about writing historical fiction. Candace is the author of nearly 20 novels set in the Middle Ages, from the Owen Archer and Kate Clifford mysteries, to the Margaret Carr series set against the backdrop of the Scottish Wars of Independence, to the fictional biographies of Alice Ferrers and Joan of Kent. As a trained historian, Candace is a stickler for detail when it comes to bringing the medieval world to life for her readers, so it was great to talk to her about how it's done. Although Skype wasn't always kind to us, I hope you'll enjoy our conversation, all about delicious medieval mysteries. So thanks, Candace, for joining us today to talk about writing medieval mystery novels. I'm so glad to have you here.
Oh, I'm really glad to be here. I've been looking forward to this. Thanks for having me.
Me too. We've been trying to coordinate this for a while, so I'm so glad it worked out. So your most popular series right now is your Owen Archer series, and it started with a book called The Apothecary Rose. So can you tell us a bit about Owen Archer and that series and what you're doing with that one?
Well, Owen, he's the man.
He really is.
in a very early version of the book, before it was really a mystery, he was a bad character.
Oh.
He was the guy with the patch on his eye, and this kind of unsavory character. And then when it was an agent's reader who suggested that this would sell much better if it were a mystery. And he was the person who just popped to mind because I really liked him. This was a very handsome, kind of sexy guy. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to spend time with him? And how intriguing it would be. And it was, I often told this story. It was in a yoga class. I was thinking about an article that I'd read about the longbow and how strong one needed to be and how they stood. And that if a man were blinded in the left eye, that would be devastating for an archer if you were a right-handed archer. And then I think that his patch was on the other eye in the original version. But I switched it and I thought, now I have someone who has to reshape his life and possibly not be able to do the thing that he has been known for, that has brought him up in the ranks to Captain of Archers. And I had then a character I felt I could dig into and really enjoy working with.
Yeah, I was going to ask why you chose that particular injury for him. And it seems like a way to make him have to retire from being an archer. And I was wondering how you got to have an archer that was blinded in one eye. But it makes a lot of sense the way you thought it through in your yoga class.
Yeah. Ran home and wrote a chapter.
Exactly. And I guess that's how it works sometimes. So Owen becomes kind of a reluctant detective for the Archbishop of York. So how does that happen for him?
He is working for John of Gaunt's predecessor, Hugh of Grosmont, who was the Duke of Lancaster at the time. And once he is blinded in the left eye, Grosmont takes him on as his spy, and he trains him to be able to pass as maybe a minor noble at events, to read and to know what to listen for. So he's primed for something like this. And then Grosmont dies. And he has spoken to his good friend, John Thoresby, Archbishop of York, about Owen. And Owen now is free. He's thinking of going over to Italy and becoming a mercenary, a man for hire, when Archbishop Thoresby summons him to York, and he wants him to investigate the death of his ward. So that's how I get Owen to York. And very reluctant, yet he has a choice of being a mercenary, staying with the Duke of Lancaster, who's now John of Gaunt, and he doesn't quite trust him. And he feels, well, an archbishop will at least be a moral, ethical person, and it will be less against his values to work for him than to work for John of Gaunt, which doesn't prove quite true.
Not exactly true. And Owen is an outsider to York in a lot of different ways, because Owen is from Wales, isn't he? Cornwall? Wales.
He's from the west coast of Wales. And when I was looking at the theory of writing crime novels, there are a lot of experts who say that, like, Sherlock Holmes was on sort of the outside of his society in a way. He's an outsider. And the outsider is the more interesting because he is like a cultural lens. He is learning about this culture at the same time that he is detecting, he's investigating. And he's a little distrusted because he is an outsider. It just makes for a very interesting mix. And of course, with Owen being this tall, strong man with the patch over his eye, he's just a very interesting character, but also a threatening character. And I just thought that was delicious.
I love it too. And then Owen meets Lucy, who is working in the apothecary, her husband's apothecary. And why did you pick this as her profession? I mean, it works for the first story. Were you thinking further along when you put Lucy in the apothecary's job?
I wanted a woman. I had read a lot at that point about the middle class, the merchant class women, and how they had more independence, really, than the wealthier, than the noble women. And I thought that she would be very interesting. And if I'm writing about a city, I want a place where lots of people come, where she would hear a lot, where she would be the center of some sort of communication. And I was fascinated. I was just in my first house and putting together an herb garden. So I was experimenting with teas and I was learning all about herbs, and it was just the perfect thing to funnel all of that information into was my Lucy.
Yeah, and it's very useful for murder mysteries to have someone who's in charge of poisons and cures. So it works nicely. So in your books, you have another series, which I'd like to get into in a minute, but in the Owen Archer books, York, the city, is almost its own character. So why did you pick York?
Well, the very honest answer is I loved York, and I wanted an excuse to be there a lot.
But fair enough.
it was the third largest city in England and the largest city in the north for a long time. And you have the Archbishop of York, who is the second most important member of the church in England. He's second only to the Archbishop of Canterbury. He was also, now I cheated a little with John Thoresby. He was Lord Chancellor, but he wasn't Lord Chancellor quite as late as I have him being. But I thought, what a delicious mix to have the Archbishop of York and the Lord Chancellor of England right there and Owen working for him. York was also a wealthy city. It was for the wool trade. The merchants were mostly involved in the wool trade, although other things. It was a tidal river at the time. So you did have the ships coming into the Staithes with all sorts of goods coming in and going out. It was a bustling city, an important city. It had some very large abbeys nearby, and I always move about into the abbeys. And it's just such a wonderful setting, the north and the moors. And York itself, it seemed to choose itself.
It's a beautiful city. I love it. So your other series that you've set also in York is the Kate Clifford series. So how is that different from your Owen Archer series?
It's different because, for one thing, I have a woman as the central character and sleuth. Kate is a young widow with a lot of baggage that she's carrying with her, and some very interesting business arrangements. And it's also, I set it in 1399 to begin with, because I wanted to start with the conflict between Richard II and Henry Bolingbroke, who was to become Henry IV. York had a lot to do with that conflict, which seems odd, the city in the north, but as the series goes on, people will understand why I really wanted to set this in York. I wanted to explore what this sort of royal argument, how that would affect the average person, how that would affect the people in the towns, how confused they might be about with whom to be loyal. And so I thought that Owen might be a little too old by that time to really be a believable agent. So I came up with a new character. And I wanted it to be a woman. I gave Kate close relations with a man who is the mayor of York many times and is favored by Henry Bolingbroke in the future, but was also favored by Richard II in the past. I gave her connections with the Dean of York at the time. He was a Clifford. And I gave her a business in which she provides discreet rooms for the wealthy of York and their mistresses to have assignations, so that I give Kate this knowledge of everybody's secrets.
Well, yes. So the way that Kate solves her murder mysteries, because these are also murder mysteries, she solves them a lot differently than Owen does. So how do you work Kate's solutions?
Well, the thing that I've noticed, that I had noticed writing the Owen Archers, was that when Lucy was sleuthing, when she was helping him, she worked through a network of women, because women could not necessarily just go. She wasn't an official, whereas Owen, in his way, was assigned by the Archbishop of York to investigate something. So he could go straight to the source. He had some authority, whereas Lucy didn't. So she would be working with a network of women and men and everyone that she knows in the city, and they would be spinning out questions to people that they trusted and they knew. And I use that with Kate. So Kate is not in any way an official investigator of crimes, but she's usually involved because it affects her life. It affects somebody that she cares very much for. It affects her business. She will be sleuthing. She does sleuth through a network of people. She communicates what she needs. She knows who to go to for what sort of information. She has a maidservant who was one of the invisible children on the street children, who keep up a network with her so that she can use them as her ears and eyes through the town. And somebody at Kalamazoo at the International Congress on Medieval Studies last year posted a wonderful graphic of how direct Owen's investigations are, and the circle of people who become involved, the circles just widened and widened and widened, this network that becomes involved in Kate's investigations. And I think that is just a characteristic of how women actually were able to have some power in the Middle Ages, by their networks of friends, their networks, whereas the men could be more direct. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense to me. Yeah, for sure. What I wanted to ask next was, your characters of Kate and your characters of Lucy and a few other women, they're very strong women. They're very independent. And I was wondering if you ever get pushback from people who say, this is not historically accurate.
Yes, I do. And I find it very amusing that people would think that simply because women were not in powerful positions, that they wouldn't have the backbones that we have today.
Yeah.
And how did women ever, I mean, just thinking about somebody like Joan of Kent, who is the wife of the Black Prince, and when he dies, she is the one who guides her son, Richard II, as a child to become king. And she's a very powerful, very strong woman who is very careful about those she trusts. I just don't understand why people think that women could not be strong. But the interesting thing that I found myself doing was creating a background for Kate that explained why she would have skill with weapons, why she would be a strong woman, why she would think independently. Whereas I didn't feel that I needed to do that with Owen.
Oh, that's interesting. I remember talking to you at Kalamazoo about when you created Kate, and you almost created her sort of in reaction to another book that you'd written, because you'd written under the name Emma Campion as well, and you'd written about Alice Ferreira's and how her life was extremely difficult in a lot of ways, and how Kate was sort of a reaction to that.
I'd actually done two women of the royal court in a row. I'd done Alice Ferreira's, and then I'd done Joan of Kent. And I thought, I was so frustrated with how constrained their lives were as noble women, as Joan, as a royal, how she had to fight for, in my opinion, she fought for the man she truly loved, because she did choose to be buried next to him rather than the prince. And that feeling of not being able to change their destinies, to not being in control of that, I believe that that's why Kate came to me, because Kate actually presented herself to me when I was trying to think of what I'm going to work on next. I just saw her with her two Irish wolfhounds flanking her, and I thought, okay, I need to know this one.
Yeah, tell me more about yourself.
Yes, exactly.
Talking about how you are trying to set fictional characters. I mean, you've been dealing with real people in the form of Alice and Joan, and now you're creating fictional characters in a real historic setting, and especially with the Clifford family, you have real historical people. So what are some of the issues that you come up against when you're doing this? Like, what are some of the obstacles that you have in placing something in the 14th century instead of in today's time?
I have to be very careful with people's attitudes. And sometimes it means that they are less open. I have them being very aware of their faith and how their faith structures their lives. I also have a character who is not a Christian in Magda Digby, who comments on Christians and their superstitions. It's what she feels, a lot of it is. But I have to be very careful with that. And then with the actual historic figures, well, like with John Thoresby, I let him be Lord Chancellor a little longer than he actually was. I also found it very frightening to create a personality for Geoffrey Chaucer, because everybody is going to jump on me about this. But so far, no one ever has, which just pleased me no end. Maybe you think that he would be a very interesting person, but very, very nosy.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, he drives Owen crazy. He's a great sidekick at times for Owen.
Oh my gosh. I can't really imagine those two together, actually.
No, it's challenging. And when I brought, for instance, in the 10th Owen Archer, I brought Joan of Kent to Bishop Thorpe to meet with John Thoresby on his deathbed. And I tried to be very careful about who she would be with, who she would bring with her, what her concerns would be. And it can change the story. I need to keep the story in mind all the time because these are mysteries and they need to move in a certain way and they need to have suspense. And at the same time, I feel that I need to be respectful to the history. There is an unspoken bond, I believe, between the writer of historical fiction and the reader, that I will be as accurate as possible. And when I'm not, I will tell you that in the novel too.
Yeah, you have historical notes in each of these books, which I really appreciate because you're very precise about what you may have needed to change and what you haven't changed, which I think is great. Is there a line that you won't cross when it comes to blurring fiction and history?
Oh, you mean something that I simply would not do?
Yes.
Well, as I said, their attitudes, I think, are very important. And when I'm working on something like the Kate Clifford series or my earlier Margaret Carr series set in Scotland at the beginning of the Wars of Independence, I am very careful to not change around what we know of the order of events, where the battles were, who the major characters were. And so all of that I try to be very careful about. And I try not to write about a place that I've never been to, which meant a lot of travel, especially at the beginning of the Owen Archer series, just to see all the places I might set some of the events.
It's great how careful you've been with York, because you can actually do an Owen and Lucy tour of York. You can walk around and you can follow the streets and see where everything was, which is, I think, really a great bit of attention to detail because much of York as a medieval city is intact in terms of streets. And so it's nice to be able to see how things played out. And I think that adds to your books as well, to be able to walk that and see how far is it from the Minster to, say, Lucy's house. So you were a historian before you started writing novels, mm-hmm. weren't you?
Right. Yes, I was on my PhD in, Anglo-Saxon and medieval literature, and I was very interested in the cultural backgrounds of all of that. So I just continued my research.
Well, the 14th century is a long way from Anglo-Saxon. So what pulled you into the 14th century?
Chaucer. And his description of life in the Canterbury Tales is so vibrant. I thought, yes, this would be the time to place my stories. And it's a wonderful time of shifting power in the Middle Ages, in the 14th century, where you do have this merchant class gaining some authority and some power in the government. So I felt like I had a larger slate to play with.
In a way, it's a lot easier to research the 14th century because there's more documentation, which is handy.
Yes.
And York is especially good with its records in some ways. When you were preparing to write these books, how did you do your research? What kind of research did you do?
Well, I did a lot of reading in the libraries in York and made a point of getting to know some of the people who were working on the history. So I think Jeremy Goldberg and I have known each other from possibly the second book I worked on. He was so generous with information. And Pat Cullum, who happens to be his wife, has been very helpful with information. Mark Ormrod. There are a lot of people, a lot of friends in York who are the big names in medieval research. So I've been very fortunate, my friend.
So you reached out to them and asked them for help? Is that how it worked out?
Yes. I when I'm stumped, when I'm looking everywhere in original sources, primary sources, and secondary sources, and there are so many questions that are never actually answered in many of these documents. Like, okay, we know that somebody might be referred to as Dom something in a manuscript, but if you came upon, one of the kinds of questions I asked, if I met an Augustan or an Austin canon on the street, what form of address would I use? And no one agrees. Many different answers. How wealthy would a person have to be to have an indoor stairs or a hearth at the time, rather than just the fire circle in the middle of the hall? Those are the sorts of questions that are very difficult. Less difficult now. In the time that I've been writing, much has been published. But when I started in the early 90s, there was so much that I couldn't find.
And it's those small life details that make a huge difference, especially in a mystery, I would think.
Yes. And, you know, some of the clues I needed to know what I was curious about when Henry Bolingbroke was not yet committed to fighting to take over the kingship, but was planning to come out of exile, whether his seal changed.
Right.
And Mark Ormerod could tell me that it did. And at what points it appears that his seal is evolving. So I was able to use that as a clue in one of the Kate Cliffords. So that little bit of detail that only if you know the right people can you find. It's just such a gift for a mystery writer.
Yes, yes. And when I talk to people who are writers, they often ask, what are the best sources that they can use to build a Middle Ages that is accurate? So what would you say to those people? What are the best resources you can use when you're building this time?
Boy, that's a tough one.
I think so.
I've been building it over so many years. There are a number of books now, and I'm not going to think of the names of them, but there's one by Ian Mortimer about like a traveler's guide to the Middle Ages.
That's right. It's the Time Traveler's Guide to Medieval England.
And he gives a lot of very interesting little detail that I wish I'd had, you know, in the early 90s. I think that reading Chaucer is a really great place to start to get an idea, a feel of things. There is a wonderful resource in York. Christianity and Culture has put out three now. They were CD-ROMs, now they're on a thumb drive, that give amazing collections of information about pilgrimage, about cathedrals, about parish churches. Because so much of what people don't understand from today, what we learn today about the Middle Ages, is the whole church structure and how important it was. And that's extremely helpful. Looking at something like that, there's a great deal online now with medievalist.net. I mean, plenty of information there. But I think it's important to learn who the very trustworthy sources are. So if you're looking for books about York in the Middle Ages, you can't go wrong with Sarah Rees-Jones or Palliser. There are certain writers that you get to know are the ones that other historians reference. There's a wonderful, huge atlas that came out a few years ago of York through the ages. I'm sure there are things like that for other cities. So it's a wide collection. One of the things that I did as I toured around England was always collect the little guides they have to the historical sites that will show you how it was laid out. They often have a reconstruction of what it might have looked like in the 14th century. I'm talking about castles and manor houses and cathedrals and bishops' palaces. Wonderful ways to get detail that you can use, that you're going to need to use when you're describing something. And of course, go to the place and walk it. When I wanted to describe Pontefract Castle, and I didn't have to use that much of it, but Richard II is imprisoned there in the third Kate Clifford, I contacted a friend who happens to be in charge of the programs at Pontefract, and he gave me a tour of what they know and gave me a description of where they believe the rooms were that Richard III was kept, and what he might have smelled and what he might have heard, which created the possibility of describing a scene that made it very real to my readers.
I think that's true about Ian Mortimer's book. As you were saying, he mentions more than just what you would see, but what you might smell and hear and all those things, which I think is really useful when you're trying to build it for yourself.
It is. I mean, I've even recorded the sound of the wind at Scarborough Castle so that if I needed to describe that.
Now that is attention to detail right there.
It's fun too.
Yeah, for sure. And you can really tell the care that you put into the books. It's coming from a place of real love for this time, which is probably why I like them. I mean, I met you before I read the Owen Archer series, and I was so delighted to actually love the series because I thought you were so great and I really appreciated your passion. So I was glad to love those books.
I'm glad that you were glad to love those books.
Before we wrap things up, for those people who are listening to this podcast to pick up details and to learn a little bit about the Middle Ages so that they can build their own fiction, what would you say to them about how to do this and how to jump in and really build a believable Middle Ages? Not just the resources, but what else would you say to them that they need to bear in mind if they're going to set fiction in the Middle Ages?
I think that they need to world build, just like a science fiction or fantasy writer world builds. They need to sample the literature and the music. I now sing in the medieval women's choir, and it's really brought a deeper understanding of the music, that sort of thing, to know the culture and the arts, the foods. There's so much more that you need to know in world building for writing this sort of thing than you would need to know for teaching the Canterbury Tales in a classroom, because you are trying to bring people to life day to day. So just think of everything that's in a world that you would need to create and look for the sources to give you the information you need. And it's quite a wide variety of things.
Yes, but then you may pick up a really interesting hobby along the way, right?
That's right. That's right. You might have a medicinal garden or learn archery or start singing in a medieval choir. Yes,
as many of us do, I think. We pick up these hobbies along the way. Well, thank you so much, Candace, for being here. It's been awesome to talk to you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And I really encourage people to go out and read your Owen Archer books. And I'm going to get on the Kate Clifford books really soon.
Oh, you need to. You need to. She's quite a woman.
I am so looking forward to it. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Danielle.
Medieval mystery fans can rejoice as the 11th Owen Archer novel, A Conspiracy of Wolves, hits bookstores in the UK in late April, with North Americans getting our fix in early August. If you're a Kate Clifford fan, you can pick up Book 3, A Murdered Peace, which is still hot off the press, having just come out in December. For Candace's tour dates, as well as to find out which books you need to add to your collection, you can check out her website at CandaceRobb.com. That's CandaceRobb.com. Or you can find her on Facebook or Twitter. Before we go, here's Peter from Medievalist.net telling us what's on the website. What's new, Peter?
Hi, Danielle. Well, what's new is a lot of news, actually, that we've been coming into the website and we've been kind of reporting on. There's stuff like this $1 million that a couple of medieval scholars got to study philosophy. Good on them. We have this link of between in Ireland and the Islamic world in this 15th century manuscript. And the one that my favorite kind of news piece for last week is that the University of Toronto bought this 15th century manuscript of Christine de Pizan. So this is really kind of cool. So we have that kind of news on the website. And if you're looking for a little longer read, Beth Rogers has started kind of a mini series on Valkyries in the Norse world. So all that's up on the website now and more to come.
That's awesome. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
Thank you to all of you listening in for making this little podcast grow every week and for subscribing across channels. Before you go, don't forget to give us a quick rating to help us become visible to more people wherever you're listening. If you have comments or suggestions, you can drop me an email at danielle@medievalists.net. That's Daniele at medievalists.net. For some helpful avenues for your own historical research, or just for some great reads, you can follow medievalists.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sabalski, all over social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5-Minute Medievalist. If you need some quick and fun information, or if your next novel happens to involve zombies, you may want to check out my books, which you can always find on Amazon. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks so much for listening, and have an awesome day.